today on Against the Grain. Reclaiming the commons may sound good in the abstract, but what's being done on a practical level? I'm CS. Gay Chan and Nandita Sharma talk about projects like Free Gardens and Free Stores, and Ren Arai discusses their edited volume, Nourishing Resistance, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What if all the things we need in order to live ceased to be commodities? What if they were free for the taking? What if resources that have been privatized and enclosed were retaken and distributed without cost? What would working together to produce food and other items to give away for free, what would that do to our capacity as humans to cooperate, to engage in mutual aid, to help strangers? Gay Chan and Nandita Sharma are co-founders of Eating in Public, which initiates projects like Free Gardens, Free Stores, and what they call Diggers Dinners. Gay Chan is a conceptual artist, educator, and organizer. Nandita Sharma is a sociologist, active in movements struggling for the planetary commons. The two contributed an essay about eating in public to the volume Nourishing Resistance, Stories of Food, Protest, and Mutual Aid, published by PM Press. Later this hour, you'll hear from the book's editor, Ren Arai. When I connected with Gay and Nandita, I asked Nandita about Eating in Public's mission.
The goal and mission of Eating in Public is to end the rule of capitalists and states and to reclaim our commons, this time at a planetary level, so that no one is excluded, no one is abandoned, no one is seen as useless. We're all in it together, for each other.
And Nandita, how would you define the commons?
The commons is a place where no one can be excluded, which means we need to figure out how to live with one another in ways that work for everyone. There is so much abundance on this planet that all of us can have a perfectly good life without having to see others around us with nothing. So I think the commons is, you know, a site, it's our planet, but it's also a relationship, right? It's a relationship to the planet and to every living being on it that is capable of producing peace and justice, which is in short supply today.
And Gay Chan, what Nandita just laid out was a very ambitious, wide-reaching, wide-ranging project and goal. How does Eating in Public go about that? We're going to talk about specific projects over the course of this hour, but I understand this to be sort of a practical effort, a practice-based approach to achieving that goal on some level.
Yeah, so I'm trained as an artist, so I am much more on the ground part of Eating in Public. What we do is we establish systems, anarchist systems of free exchange. And this could be exchange of goods, of labor, of skills. And so the different platforms that we have developed, like the free stores or the guerrilla gardens or seed sharing, or is to invite people into these spaces without really being very prescriptive about how they should engage, and for them to bring whatever they want to bring or take whatever they want to take in these spaces that liberate them from all the confines that the state and capitalist system has enclosed us into.
And when you say anarchism, what are the main features of anarchist practice, anarchist living that you're talking about?
So anarchism to us in eating in public is about the respect of liberty and freedom, and fostering ways and systems that allow us to live with one another in peace, and justice while maintaining our autonomy. So anarchism to me is, this kind of love of freedom, while, having a deep, deep respect for our relationships to one another and our reliance on one another for our freedoms.
So how do we put anarchism to work on the ground? And I think that what we've done is to create systems where we don't provide a lot of instructions on how to engage, and we let people overcome their own fears and try. And I think it's through this trying that we learn to be commoners, because the commons is an anarchistic space. And I want to do also, Nandita talked about the love for freedom. I think that freedom is very scary too, because you are totally responsible for your own actions. So freedom is just not, love and joy, but it's the utter exhilarance of coming up with the courage to overcome all the entrapments that we've been taught.
Well, let's talk about 2003 in Hawaii, where you both are based. What motivated you folks to launch Eating in Public in that year?
This project started without our explicit goal to start a project. It started from confusion and abundance or overabundance. What happened is that I am an obsessive composter, and not knowing at the time that I shouldn't throw papaya seeds into the composter, we ended up with just tens or even hundreds of papaya seedlings that I didn't want to throw out. So the papaya seedlings became both the origins of the free gardens, because we had to plant them somewhere, and also the first inventory in our first free store.
And share more. So what did you do with the materials you were working with, and at what site?
We lived in a quite an uptight, conservative neighborhood, but there were some fallow spaces that we thought we would just plant the papayas. And it's really through this project that Eating in Public started, because we realized as we were digging in unauthorized spaces, we were continuing the projects of the diggers in the space that we now know as England.
Yeah, the diggers in the 17th century. Can you tell us more about what the diggers were about, what their project or even political project was?
The diggers of the 17th century in, the place we now call England were amongst the first victims of capitalist expropriation of land. They had a commons upon which anyone could enter and use the land and the water to sustain themselves. When capitalism began, one of the very first acts was to destroy people's ability to be self-sufficient, and make them completely dependent on capitalist markets. So commons were enclosed by hedges and fences and trenches. And so what the diggers literally did was dig up the hedges that enclosed their commons and dug in plants from which they could get a meal, because they were literally being forced to starve. So we really loved the diggers both for their rebellion against capitalism, but also for their sense of themselves and their, you know, their identity as through their practice of digging. So they called themselves the diggers because that's exactly what they were doing. And we wanted to explicitly identify ourselves in the 21st century as diggers in order to both signal that this isn't a new project and the commons can still be had even though capitalism has expanded and infiltrated our lives in ways that would have been unimaginable for the 17th century diggers.
I think there's two parts of this practice that's particularly interesting to me and has really changed my overall practice as an artist. One is that what Nandita is talking about, that the diggers call themselves diggers because they dig. I've been trained, or most artists have been trained, to kind of work from a representational or symbolic or metaphorical framework. But what I love about eating in public is that what we're doing is exactly what we're doing. So it makes what we do so clear and understandable to other people, and the politics comes through the doing, through the participation. It's not like trying to decipher what the work is about. The other thing that I like is that in contemporary art, or since modernity really, the idea of originality and authorship is very important, and I think that that's certainly the case with capitalism and copyright laws. So eating in public is shamelessly unoriginal. We copy the first diggers. We also have copied the subsequent diggers, like in San Francisco diggers and the New York diggers. They've also started free stores and try to give money away. So I love the shamelessness of our ethos in that regard.
So the scene is Kailua on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. And the year is 2003, and you had these papaya trees, 20 baby papaya trees that you wanted to plant. Continue your story of what happened, what you did, and what the response was.
There was a piece of land that we would walk by every day on our way to the park where we jogged. And we would see this piece of land, and it was fenced, and on one side was private property, and there was a sign that declared, you know, who the private property owner was and that there was no trespassing, and a big chain link fence. And then on the road side of the chain link fence was state property, public property. And it was completely fallow, and basically, you know, dogs would pee there and joggers would run on the grass. And it was just a huge stretch of land not being used. So we thought that that was a really good place to put the papayas because this was a very well-trafficked area. And people would therefore see the papayas and be able to pick them. So we planted the plants and we put up a sign, and just to paraphrase our sign, it basically said, we've planted these papaya seedlings for everyone, you know, please feel free to take care of them, don't use pesticides because that will hurt the plants and the beings that eat them, and we just signed it the diggers, and that was it. And the plants grew. Papayas grow very quickly. In about a year, you'll have a full, you know, mature tree that provides fruit. So a very, very fast plant. So perfect for this situation. And then another sign popped up from the person who was employed by the private property owner that basically said, I've been instructed to tear down these papaya plants. So please move them. And so we thought about it for a while, and we wrote another sign back, all in public. This is all happening in public. So we responded with our own sign that just said, you know, we really cannot think of a better place to plant these plants. And, you know, we look forward to see what you do. And then a short time later, the plants were mowed down. They were like, you know, hacked, like, so you could still see the stumps of the little baby papaya trees. And then they moved the private property fence further towards the road so that the stumps were now on the private property side. So they tried to reduce the amount of land that was there. And then we would hear people say, like, who did that? That's so mean. Like, it's just papaya plants. Like, what is the big deal? So then we put up another sign and said, we are going to expand the garden. If you want to join us, please come on this day and time. And, you know, some people actually came and we expanded the garden. We planted basil and chili peppers and spinach and, of course, more papayas. And then it was left alone. So it was this, it was in the face of this seeming loss, right, that the private property owner is exerting their authority, taking down the plants. And then it flourished because it upset people, right? People were upset by what happened. And that was the kind of basis for expanding the project. So that was a good lesson for us that, you know, these David and Goliath stories always work for David in people's imagination.
That voice belongs to Nandita Sharma. She and my other guest, Gay Chan, are co-founders of Eating in Public. Nandita is an activist scholar based at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Gay is also a professor there and a conceptual artist and organizer. And the two of them contributed a chapter titled Remaking the Commons, A History of Eating in Public, to the volume Nourishing Resistance, Stories of Food, Protest, and Mutual Aid. I'm CS, and the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You did not ask permission before planting the papaya originally, or for creating an expanded garden in the space remaining between the relocated fence and the street. And I understand you never ask for permission. This reflects your opinions and convictions about property rights, which are what?
I think it's a fantasy. I think it's yet another fantasy that they have gotten most of us to believe that they exist.
Private property, to paraphrase a very famous anarchist, private property is theft. It's the theft of the commons. Common property is available to all who work on it. So we basically oppose exclusion and abandonment, and that is precisely what private property does. But also, you know, Eating in Public is very clear that we are not trying to replace private property with public property. You know, there's a bit of a misunderstanding, I think, when people think of the public, they think that that is themselves, right? Because they've been told that they're members of the public. Public property is state property, and that is also part of the theft of the commons. So we want the commons back. We want a world in which no one can be excluded from enjoying the wealth and fruits of this planet.
So it sounds like you planted these plants, and as you said, you left some instructions or some advice to people who might see these plants growing, and, you know, if you can take care of them, great. And I think it was the signs said something like, you know, we'll be back every month or a few weeks to add fertilizer or something like that. But it sounds like the focus was really not on the two of you running anything, but rather inviting people, enlisting them to run it themselves, that it would be sort of a autonomous, self-running project. Fair to say?
Absolutely, that's fair to say. It's a practice-based project, not only for ourselves, but through all others, strangers, known and unknown entities, to try and figure out if they can participate, if they want to participate, and how to participate. And it's really this last aspect of how to participate that has been the most exciting part of Eating in Public, because through it, I have learned how little we know and how much has been taken from us. And I'm talking about like knowledge and skill. So I want to return back to the first garden when we grew basil and mint or whatever it was. I can't quite remember. Is that we realize that people, most people, are trained to shop, but they don't even know what things are or how to harvest it. So it was really this moment that my interest in instructional media began, because I had to make signs that labeled the plants, and signs that told people how to harvest. Like if you were harvesting chili pepper, you don't have to cut down the whole branch or plant. And we put up posts with recipes so that people know what to do with it. And I think that the theft of knowledge and skill is part and parcel with how the commons was taken away from us, because we don't even know how to live there. And I think the larger project of eating in public is to not just want to reclaim the commons, but to get us to learn how to live there again.
Let's talk about Free Store, another of Eating in Public's signature projects. The first Free Store was started again in Kailua on Oahu, and I think this was shortly after the Free Garden was set up. What sort of structure was Free Store in, and what was on offer there?
So the Free Store was started in front of our house. We rented a small suite on top of a garage, and the landlord lived in the big house. And I would say maybe this really was the start of eating in public, because planting the papayas and then this whole David and Goliath story that we went through allowed us to see that we were onto something, that maybe there was a desire for the commons out there, and how could we foster it? And I had told Gay a story of my childhood when I was about 7 or 8 years old, living in Vancouver, Canada. My brother and I encountered a Free Store around the corner from our house. My family didn't have very much money, so the prospect of having a Free Store where we could go in and be welcome to take anything we wanted was really exciting, and I've never forgotten that experience, and how liberating it was to be liberated from money and still have the stuff that you want and you need. And so I was telling Gay this story. So Gay created a physical structure, like a shelving unit that we put in our front yard, and it was everything. So of course the first item on offer were papaya seedlings, and that allowed everyone to then understand that we were the same people that planted those papaya trees down the roads, and therefore got into a lot of great conversations with people. But there was everything and anything coming to the Free Store. And we, as Gay mentioned, we lived in a pretty uptight, suburban, relatively conservative, militarized neighborhood, and people loved the Free Store, and so that was really exciting as well. But I wanted to add one thing in terms of our practice. For us, our practice is measured, like the success of our projects and our practices is measured by other people taking it up, right? When we no longer have to run the Free Store, when other people open their own Free Stores, when other people plant their own gardens, etc., that's success for us, because that is more of us reclaiming the commons.
Yeah, and once the plants were taken or claimed by somebody walking by the Free Store there on the front lawn, what happened in terms of the restocking, the resupplying of the store, in terms of things being available for to be taken for free?
I produced a Free Store kind of like an art exhibit, so that I made kind of cute labels for the plants and signage for the stores. And I kind of thought through what it should look like and how it's designed and how it would move. And I was really shocked that within an hour, all the plants were gone and the store was empty. And then things started arriving, things that I didn't really like, that they were hideous to me and maybe even grotesque. And I really had to readjust my whole framework for what I was doing because I realized that it was a total free-for-all and I couldn't control it anymore. So again, I had to shift on what my role was at the free store. So I decided that I would leave, like, I had to build a little cubby for cardboard and a marker so people could label their inventory when they left them. So it's really, it was a constant trial and error observing what people would do and then reacting to it. So another really surprising, two surprising things that happened at the space is that maybe because we were all trained to use non-free stores, some people started leaving money at the free store. And I built a free money box. And actually, the San Francisco Diggers had a free money project as well. So I just made a little box and it just said free money. And people started leaving money in the box and taking money from the box. There was never no money in the box. So that was like an incredible exercise for me. And then someone, I presume maybe around a 10-year-old child, started using the cardboard and the markers to write pornographic messages to leave at the free store. And I'm not sure they were supposed to be his or her exploration of their sexual identity or interests, or they were poetry. But again, I love how anarchist it is. Like, it's just a space for you to explore whatever you want to do.
There was also free fridge, right?
So yes, there was a free fridge. Actually, there were several free fridges because people kept taking the fridge, thinking the fridge was free rather than the fridges for the free store. But anyway, like the other parts of free store, new threads, or what are they called, split offs or splinter off, happened because something occurs that was a concern for the users. So the second free store that we started was at the University of Hawaii. And for a while, frozen chicken thighs would show up at the free store, and then would cause incredible discussion about what do we do with this chicken, whether we should cook it, throw it away, whether we would get botulism. And so the free fridge became the solution for the frozen chicken that would appear. And actually, it took me about a year to figure out how the chicken appeared. And it was they were brought by Loy, one of the houseless people at the university. He would go to the food bank, and somehow he got these frozen chicken as well, but he didn't have a kitchen to cook it in. So he decided he would share the frozen chicken thighs.
That's Gay Chan. She is an artist, educator, and organizer. And she and my other guest, Nandita Sharma, are co-founders of Eating in Public. It began in 2003. I'm reading here, Eating in Public is an anti-capitalism project nudging a little space outside of the commodity system, following the path of pirates and nomads, hunters and gatherers, diggers and levelers. They gather at people's homes, plant free food gardens on private and public land, and set up free stores, all without permission. We have a link to Eating in Public on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as to the volume Nourishing Resistance: Stories of Food, Protest, and Mutual Aid, to which Gay and Nandita contributed a chapter about eating in public. And the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. What is Eating in Public's motto?
It is take, leave, whatevers.
And there's an add-on there. It's take, act without shame, leave, share without condition, whatevers, trust without apology.
And I think the first two kind of make sense to me right away. Act without shame and share without condition, trust without apology. Elaborate on what that means to the two of you.
To me, it means allowing yourself to fully embrace the possibilities that open up for you, particularly when it's something that you've never encountered before. And don't feel that you need to apologize for that, right? You don't need to apologize for expanding your world, for changing your mind, for doing something you were told to never do in order to fit into the current system. And in particular, we've been taught our entire lives not to trust strangers, you know, to be fearful of the other, to be suspicious and attack the foreigner. And so one of the things that we have found in Eating in Public is that each of our projects relies on the stranger, right? The person we don't know who leaves the things for us at the free store, who takes the things that we think are useless to us from the free store, who weeds the garden, who waters it, who picks the plants so that they don't rot on the ground. The stranger is really, really central. And I think that that, you know, has for me become a really crucial part of what we're doing, is expanding our sense of who this we is that we think we're a part of.
And Nandita, I know this ties into your critique of the nation state. We've had you on before to talk about that. Elaborate a little bit more on sort of the we that we are encouraged to coalesce around, whether it's the nation state, or in fact, the two of you have a critique of community, the word community, the concept community. How strong is the pressure for us to associate ourselves with a we, and what are the dangers of that?
There's two things there that I think are important to pick apart. One is we have been divided. So the we that we belong to are just a small slice of all the life on this planet, right? So the big one, of course, is that we need to separate ourselves from all other living beings and imagine ourselves as their, you know, ruler. But amongst humans, we've been separated by ideas of race, ideas of gender, ideas of nation, especially today. And all of those are in service to maintaining class and state rule, right? The kind of exclusions that come with private and state property, the kinds of exclusions from wealth and nourishment that come with a class and state system are reflected in these kind of narrow identities that we've been taught to associate with. So, you know, we can see that in all of the contemporary news that we hear on the radio each day, you know, the wars, the impoverishment, the famines, the exterminations, the expulsions, you know, allowing people to die in the Rio Grande, right? Because they're strangers and foreigners. All of it is wrapped up in perpetuating a system that convinces us that exclusion is the highest calling that we have in order to protect this small we. And so Eating in Public wants to make the most expansive we that can exist, right? That's why we also demand that the commons be at a planetary level so that we don't once again silo ourselves off into quote-unquote communities that define themselves against some foreign other.
Gay Chan, two other Eating in Public projects focus on edible weeds. One is called Weeds, and there's a parenthesis around the ED, the last ED of that, and Weeds Up Front. What do these projects involve?
So first, let me explain the parentheses. So it stands, is it short for education? This really builds on what Nandita was talking about before, and your question about community and about belonging. So Hawaii, because of our climate, things just grow really easy here. So people complain a lot about having too much life, basically, where they have to hack things back or pull things out. There's rapid use of herbicide and insecticide because of this utter abundance and beauty. So I've really spent a lot of time learning about beneficial insects and what we call weeds, meaning unwanted plants, and many of them are actually edible and very delicious and nutritious, and some are even medicinal. So this is another lost knowledge, I believe, that when we were kicked off the commons, that not only have they removed our resources from us, they remove the knowledge that we don't even know what remains available to us. So there are two parts to my thinking through plants that are there that we know nothing about, is to establish planters. So they look like, from an art perspective, they're like framed in a way. So what you would think, like what's within the frame is something you should look at, and outside the frame, it's like nothing. It's unintentional. So I've either planted weeds or let just the weeds grow inside of these planters. And very often they look exactly like what's outside of the planters. And these become educational displays, if you will. They're often attached to free stores. So people, I will do impromptu weed tasting. There was a crew of cable guys here recently to reinstall the streets cables, and they tasted a whole bunch of weeds raw. Me and another collaborator, Bundit, also do pop-up weed cooking demonstrations and tastings. So we've done quite a lot of these, and so besides just tasting raw weeds, we demonstrate a number of recipes. People can try them out. We make tea out of certain kind of weed leaves that we dry. So again, it's to kind of reinstill us with the knowledge of what's there, and hopefully, as we rebuild this knowledge, there would be less hatred for things that we think don't belong. We rethink about why we think they don't belong in the first place, minimize the use of insecticide and herbicide. And so it's all, for me, it's all about just seeing what's in front of me rather than having these preconceived ideas of what should be in front of me.
Eating in Public also came up with a project called Diggers Dinners. Tell us about that.
The Diggers Dinners are basically potlucks, but they have a specific set of guidelines that distinguish them from your average potluck. And that is that the main ingredient of the dish that people bring to share needs to have been obtained outside the capitalist market. And it's kind of profit-making machine, right? Remembering that capitalism was the first system to put food in the market, thereby really capturing us within this kind of way of being. So Diggers Dinners, the guidelines are that your main ingredient should have come from either being grown, fished, hunted, gathered, foraged, or stolen. And everyone that comes shares how they got their main ingredient, and then that becomes the basis for expanding our sense that we don't need markets to eat. And there's a terrific story that happened at one of our Diggers Dinners, the largest one that we've had at the University of Hawaii. One woman came. She must have been in her 80s, if not her 90s. She was very small. She was a bit hunched over. And we asked everyone to go up to a microphone because there was a lot of people there, and tell us where they got their ingredients. And she stood up and she said I've been waiting for this my entire life. And everyone just stops and looks at her. It's like, what? And she goes, I brought these bananas by stealing them from the shop. And then I went to another shop and I stole these apples. And the whole crowd just erupted. It was a fantastic moment just to let us again expand our understanding of who the people around us are, right? What are they capable of? What are the, you know, are we all waiting for the commons as this woman has all of our lives without knowing it?
We'll have to leave it there on that provocative note. Nandita Sharma, co-founder with Gay Chan of Eating in Public, is a sociologist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and an active member of several social movements, including the No Borders Movement and movements struggling for the Planetary Commons. Gay is an artist and organizer and a professor in the Department of Art and Art History at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. The chapter they contributed to the volume Nourishing Resistance has the title Remaking the Commons: A History of Eating in Public. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. We turn now to the editor of Nourishing Resistance: Stories of Food, Protest, and Mutual Aid. Ren Arai is a writer and archivist whose work focuses on the intersection of food and radical politics. When Ren and I connected recently, they had this to say about the focus of Nourishing Resistance.
So it's a collection of different stories that look at the role that food and cooking play in different protest movements, social justice movements, mutual aid efforts, you know, the way that food is an important part of that.
And what inspired you to put together this volume? You had a kind of involvement with these kinds of issues and questions for a period of time before this book came together, right?
Yes. So I started working a little bit when I was younger with Food Not Bombs in high school, and I had done cooking in different sort of environmental campaigns I was part of, and I cook for community dinners every once in a while at the community space I'm part of. So this has been sort of part of my entire life. And in terms of what inspired me, I think this actually has changed a lot, and we're seeing a lot more writing and other forms of media about the role that food plays within social movements. But when I first started thinking about this book 5 or 6 years ago, or it started becoming like a little bit of a germ of an idea, that wasn't as common. Like, cooking was sort of pushed to the side. You hear more about, you know, a little bit more about farming, a little bit more about food distribution, which are also part of the book. But yeah, it wasn't as much of a topic of conversation as I feel like it is today, which is like very exciting to see it happening, sort of popping up in all sorts of places.
What surprised you about the responses you got when you put out feelers in terms of, hey, what are people thinking about in terms of food and social justice and mutual aid and popular struggle?
Well, the thing that continues to surprise me is how many pitches I got from people writing from other countries or on international topics. I feel like the anthology ended up being very international in scope, and I didn't expect that at all. I really thought I would get more stuff from the United States, which was really exciting to me. It's like very cool to be reading a piece that was, you know, written in India or written in Argentina or about South Africa or about Italy, right? And thinking about how all of these places are connected.
Is there something you're trying to get readers of Nourishing Resistance to think about more and act upon?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things, and I think each of the pieces in this anthology has their own goals around this. But for me personally, I think there's been such incredible work both on the ground and writing covering mutual aid, food distribution, a lot of things that have happened in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think personally, those things are so incredible and amazing. And also, I am interested in people also thinking about the way food plays a social role within spaces. It plays a role in which people come together and can, you know, get to know each other and scheme up ways to make this world a better place. And so it's not just the, you know, the farming side of things, the distribution side of things. It's also the cooking and preparing food together in the community side of things that has a like very strong political import.
So in other words, conviviality, to which food and food sharing contributes a ton, matters a lot to grassroots struggle, to people coming together, to people working together?
Totally, yeah. And there's actually a piece in this book that is about a movement in Buenos Aires, and it is called Cooking Revolutions in the Popular Pot. And the author, Virginia Tognola, talks about how part of the project is about feeding people, right? Part of the project is about preparing meals for folks who may not be able to afford food otherwise. But then part of it also is about sitting down and eating together and planning and organizing for the rights of folks who, you know, are economically marginalized, are migrants in Argentina. And it's like that act of eating together that allows that to happen, those connections to be built, people to have these conversations and to organize in other ways.
Ren, besides writing the introduction to this book, you also contributed a chapter with the title Abundance and Other Lessons on the Lower East Side. Summarize what you addressed in that chapter.
Totally, yeah. So that chapter was originally published at Blindfield Journal online, and I am writing sort of about my teenage years when I started working with Food Not Bombs on the Lower East Side. I grew up in the near suburbs of New York City. And then, you know, coming back to that memory later and kind of being curious about the history of food and food justice and mutual aid on the Lower East Side. So I talk about all sorts of things. I talk about the community gardens and the struggle to save the community gardens in the late 90s and early aughts. I talk about sort of this radical food history of Tompkins Square Park, which is a park that has always had this very important political place, although it's increasingly becoming very, very gentrified. And just all these different aspects of the way that food sharing, eating together, using waste, carrying out food-based mutual aid has taken place within this neighborhood that was so important to me when I was a young person.
The book also features interviews you did with Cheshire Lee, with Mayam, with Virgie Tovar, and with Mike Costello. I'm sure there's a lot that stands out to you about those conversations, about the insights your interviewees shared, but could you point out a couple things that come out in those conversations?
Yeah, I think what was most notable to me was like the sheer excitement and joy of being able to speak to people, and to speak to people who have a really different, you know, they do really different things within this realm of food and social justice, you know, whether that's being a community farmer focused on like BIPOC community farms, or really looking like Virgie Tovar, really looking at fat phobia within American society and how that relates to food. Each of these conversations was just like very, very thrilling to be able to talk to people who have such brilliance about their specific subjects. And it really ran the gamut from people that I already knew. I've been friends with Cheshire Lee for a very long time, so it was really cool to get to speak to them in depth about their food work, especially doing protest kitchens and disaster relief. And then there were other people like Alicia Galvez, who I just emailed because I had read her book, Eating NAFTA, which is amazing. And we had an amazing conversation. And so, yeah, just that opportunity to speak to people, I find very invigorating.
Yeah, in addition to the chapters you've alluded to and to the chapter by Gay and Nandita that I interviewed them about, well, what are some of the other things that people might find within the covers of your book? I know, you know, we can't talk about everything, but I'm curious what sort of occurs to you at the moment.
I guess what occurs to me right now, just because I've been nerding out about it a lot personally, and it might be evident in the piece that I wrote that's included in the book, but there's a whole, I decided not to mark out specific sections, but there are kind of sections in my head, and there's a whole section of the book that deals with food history. So there's a piece by Madeline Lane McKinley about food and sort of feminism within the commune movement of the 1960s and 70s. There's that interview with Mike Costello about Blair Mountain and the Mine Wars and food in the Mine Wars. There's a piece called Rehearsing for Rebellion that is about the relationship between the song Bella Ciao and women rice workers in Italy. There's a really, really beautiful personal essay by Shantoni Ria Ghosh, who writes about her family's history of feeding revolutionaries during the revolution and uprisings against the British in India. And so, yeah, I think that's something that I'm really excited about. I love history. I'm a big history nerd. And I hope that people come across that section because there's such incredible work happening today, but there's also these amazing histories in the past, right, that we can learn from and read about.
And Ren, who wrote the foreword to Nourishing Resistance?
Yeah, so the foreword was written by Cindy Milstein, who is an incredible anarchist writer and somebody who doesn't really identify as thinking a lot about food, but I think thinks about community and thinks about care work in a really compelling way. And we know each other. And so I asked them to write the foreword and they said yes, which was pretty amazing. And I also want to mention that to me, you know, my name is on the cover of the book, but this really was a collaborative project. It was an honor to be able to edit everyone's work, to read everyone's work, to be able to include it. And it really is that work that makes the anthology what it is. So if there is a reason to pick up Nourishing Resistance, it's because of all of these amazing contributions.
Ren Arai is their name. They are a writer, archivist, and editor of Nourishing Resistance, Stories of Food, Protest, and Mutual Aid, out from PM Press. Ren, thank you for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.